This is The Guardian.
Enjoying this podcast? Then we think you might love the audio long read, the podcast of The Guardian Long Read, with episodes about caffeine addiction, the secret life of saints, and Britain's strangest pub chain. The Long Read offers great stories and big ideas. Follow the audio long read wherever you get your podcasts.
This government will take the difficult decisions necessary to ensure there is trust and confidence in our national finances. That means decisions of eye-watering difficulty.
I was fairly confident after the mini-budget that we were going to lose.
Tonight is a bitter pill to swallow for the Conservative Party. But when you lose the trust of the electorate, all that matters is having the courage and humility to ask yourself why.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian. Hello.
Hello.
Today we're joined for a special episode of Politics Weekly with a true veteran of the Conservative Party. Since his election in 2005, he served as Chancellor, Foreign Secretary, Health Secretary, Culture, Media and Sports Secretary. Jeremy Hunt, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here.
So, what are we now, 7 months, Kieran, since the election?
About that.
And you've been in opposition for the first time in a very long time. How did it feel?
It felt strange, actually, because my first parliament was 2005 to 2010, and we were in opposition then, but we were definitely on the march. You know, David Cameron was leader. There was a sense of mission, and we had some expectation that we would win the next election. Now we've had the most crushing defeat in our history, and I'm sure it feels much more like the Conservative Party felt after 1997. So it is more challenging, and I think we are doing a lot of soul searching, and you know we're still just at the start of that journey.
And it was clear for a while that the Conservatives were on their way out, but was there a particular moment that crystallised that for you, that you knew it was over for the party?
I was fairly confident after the mini budget that we were going to lose, but I didn't ever completely give up hope because in politics, extraordinary things happen. But, you know, the reality is there'd been so much turbulence, some of it because of global black swan events like, you know, clearing up after the global financial crisis or COVID, some of it self-inflicted like Partygate and the mini budget. In the end, the voters hold governments accountable, and we've been there for 14 years, and I thought probably our number was up.
You now have a new Conservative leader. I've got two questions. First of all, slightly unfair one, but can you rank the prime ministers that you served under? Who is the best? Who is the worst? And second of all, how do you think Kemi is doing? It's obviously a difficult job coming out of that level of defeat. Can she turn it around in one term?
If you don't mind, I won't rank them, Kieran. Good question. But the reason is because they gave me my jobs that I did, and I feel a certain loyalty to them. I would say they had different qualities, but the prime ministers that I most enjoyed working with were ones who gave me a clear sense of direction and let me get on with the job. I can certainly say, to give you a positive example, that was the case when I was Health Secretary under David Cameron. He trusted me to get on with the job. I was there for 6 years, not only under him, but you know that was a positive relationship. I think Kemi has got the most difficult job in British politics, and she is rightly saying that we have to go through a period of reflection. This is not the time to rush out into, you know, social media wars, new policies, because the country smacked us in the face. They wanted us out. It was our worst ever defeat.
And they need to see that we are properly thinking. And then when we are through that period, and I think it does take some time, we come forward with a positive platform. And I think that's what Kemi's going to do.
Now, it's Tuesday morning as we're speaking to you. And last night, Monday evening, a poll came out that for the first time put the Reform Party above both Labour and the Conservatives. How much of an existential threat to the Conservatives do you think that Reform are? And how does it sit with you that the response seems to be to tack right?
Well, it is an existential threat. You just have to look at what has happened to mainstream Conservative parties in countries like France and Italy to see the dangers that we have from a more populist right-wing party. The right approach is not to copy them, because our coalition of voters will always be a different coalition of voters to Reform. There are lots of Reform voters who will never vote Conservative. They lent their vote to us in 2019 because they wanted Brexit to happen, but they are fundamentally totally anti-establishment types, and they would never vote for the Conservative Party, which they see as one of the establishment parties. So I think we have to be completely realistic about that. But we also have to learn. And by the way, this is not just the Conservative Party, but I would say the same applies to the Labour Party as well. We have to properly understand what is happening in populist movements. It's very easy to kind of dismiss them and indeed to try and make them the opponents we would like them to be. We would love them to be, you know, racist extremists, but, you know, Reform is actually led by someone who is a Muslim,
chairman of the party.
Yeah. And so it's very dangerous to try and pretend your opponents are something they are not. What they are good at, and what Donald Trump is very good at in the United States, is communication. And I remember talking to his chief of staff, telling me that he didn't get into the office, the Oval Office, until 11:30.
This is when you were Foreign Secretary.
When I was Foreign Secretary, at 11:30 midday. And for 3 or 4 hours until that point, he was watching TV. He was on social media. Now, the first time I was told that, I thought it sort of confirmed my prejudices about Donald Trump. And then I thought, think of it another way. This is someone who spends the first 3 to 4 hours of every day communicating with his base. And he's perhaps the first American president who, before he sets foot in the office, America knows what he's thinking and he knows what America's thinking. And he is a brilliant communicator. You know, if we want to win the argument for our parties, we have to be as good.
And what's the way to deal with him then? Do you need to give him a show of strength to show that you're not a pushover? Is that what he responds to? Or do you need to kind of go and kiss the ring and suck up to him because he needs to feel like the big man?
A bit of both, probably. You know, you have to kiss the ring, as Peter Mandelson has rightly done, because you have to show respect to the President of the United States. But he doesn't like pushovers. He wants people who can deliver and who say what they think. I think you've got to be very clear about what you want. And I think we should recognize, whilst everyone will have things they disagree with when it comes to Donald Trump, generally, a stronger America is a safer world. And what we are absolute prime objective in our relations with the United States is to keep America engaged in the world. And that's why the most difficult decision that Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves will have this year is about defense spending, because the UK has a totally pivotal role. If we increase defense spending to 3% of GDP, very difficult to do, very painful, although totally necessary, then France and Germany will follow and NATO will remain intact. And that has got to be a lot cheaper than the alternative, which is NATO disintegrating and us perhaps having to spend 5, 6, 7% of GDP on defence.
Can I ask you one specific policy question, which may well face this government, which is if there are to be tariffs on the UK, and at the moment we don't know if there are and we hope there are not, but if there are, should we hit back with retaliatory tariffs?
No. And the reason that you generally hit back with retaliatory tariffs, which is what China, Canada and Mexico are all in the process of doing or threatening to do, is to give you leverage so that the other side then wants to remove the tariffs that they've introduced. But our exports, goods exports to the United States, account for less than 0.5% of US GDP. So we should be very realistic. We don't have any leverage when it comes to that. And it is bad for British manufacturers who use a lot of imported materials. It's bad for inflation. We should stay out of these trade wars.
If I can just bring it back to more local politics, your party doesn't seem to be focusing quite as much on the Liberal Democrats as it has done on reform. But as you well know from your own seat, and during the election I came down while you were campaigning there, you lost a big wave of seats to the Lib Dems all across the so-called blue wall. And I think your own majority was just 891 by the end. How worried are you that come the next election, you could potentially lose scores more of those traditional small C Conservative seats?
That is a problem that will look after itself if we address the bigger question as to what our promise to the country is as an alternative to a Labour government, which I do think has had a very ropey start. Ironically, no one knows about the threat of the Lib Dems more than me. You know, I nearly faced political extinction. As you know, you visited me down in Godalming when I was fighting that David and Goliath battle against them. So I completely understand that. But actually, the people who have the identity crisis in this parliament are the Lib Dems, because in that election, they were the southern wing of the Labour Party. If you wanted to kick the Tories out, voters knew to vote Lib Dem in a seat like mine and to vote Labour in a red wall seat. And they knew that. But now the Lib Dems have got to carve an identity that makes them distinct from a government that I think will be very unpopular by the time of the next election. And they seem to be going in completely the opposite direction. They seem to be wanting to be more left-wing than the Labour Party in power. Now, that is not going to attract voters in my constituency.
One question that came up in our team during the last campaign, and I think has come up with other people that I've talked to about you, is there's a little bit of surprise that you even fought that seat and that you wanted to stay in politics. A lot of other, you know, big beasts of Conservative politics who've been around for as long as you left.
Michael Gove, Theresa election. May, Dominic Raab, the list goes on and on.
Yeah, and you, not only did you stay on, you spent £100,000 of your own money fighting that campaign. Why did you do it?
It was partly because I knew that part of the deal when I was asked to be Chancellor was that you stay and you fight your seat, because you can't be Chancellor if you're deserting a sinking ship. And I felt a sense of responsibility to do the right thing for my party, having accepted the responsibility of being Chancellor. I don't know if I hadn't been Chancellor whether I would have wanted to stay or not, but I don't want to go back to the private sector. I ran my own business, loved doing so for 14 years before I went into politics. I want to write. That's what I'm now doing as a backbencher.
Ooh, what sort of books? Novels? Do we expect a spy thriller or inside the corridors of power?
I've got a book coming out in June called Can We Be Great Again, which is about Britain's role in the world.
I can see that on a baseball cap, can't
I? I was going to say, sounds like you need a red hat.
Well, I think it's a question we should be asking ourselves, whether we are finished as a global player or not. By the way, it's incredible therapy after you've been on the front bench for, as I have, for 16 of the last 19 years, to actually just spend a morning writing. I know for you guys it's work, but for me it is pure pleasure. So I actually think Parliament's a wonderful place to do that. But I also have to be honest that having got into this life or death struggle with the Lib Dems in Godalming and Ashe, I bloody well wanted to win. So that was also part of it.
Well, Jeremy Hunt, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Kieran, I've just escorted Jeremy Hunt off the premises at Guardian Towers. So now we can dissect our conversation, can't we? What do you make of that?
I thought it was really interesting. I mean, I think it's always fascinating to talk to people when they're on the other side of power. Jeremy Hunt, as you know, in private, has always been fairly open, but he's willing to be much more so now that he's not in government. I thought what he said about tariffs was very, very interesting. It will be very tempting for the Tory party to criticise Labour if we do end up in the scenario of getting hit by tariffs from America, and if we don't retaliate, and I think at the moment the feeling is we won't retaliate. It'll be very tempting then for Kemi Badenoch to say, well, we're rolling over in the face of American threats. But as Jeremy Hunt says there, that, you know, that's not necessarily a great idea for the Tory party to go down that path. And if they want to be the party of free trade, then maybe not retaliating is the best way. He also pointed out just how little leverage we have. So I think that it is worth remembering that in this great geopolitical battle that's going on, really on three parts, China, the EU, and the US, Britain really only has a relatively minor role to play. And maybe that will save us in the end. But no, I thought it was very interesting on that. What did you think?
Well, he's always been seen as this one nation, more sort of centre-right conservative rather than sort of, you know, the wing of the party, which is now flirting with the Reform Party. So I've thought quite a lot about when he said that he was going to stand again, about where he was going to fit in to a post-election lost Conservative Party. And I've spoken to him privately before about, you know, whether he would run again as leader. And he's absolutely not. He feels that, you know, he's done his time and feels that it's, you know, time for a new generation and so on. But I definitely think that there were people who have watched what's happened to the Conservative Party in the lurch rightwards recently who take some comfort from the fact that somebody like Jeremy Hunt is still in Parliament, not because he was universally acclaimed or loved in any of those roles, and not because he is without criticism for, you know, some of the decisions that his government, bear in mind he was there all through the austerity years and including, of course, when he was Health Secretary, but he compared, frankly, to a lot sort of some of the more noisier, punchier Tory politicians we've got used to more recently, the sort of the populists. He seems kind of like the grown up in the room, right?
He feels like a relic from another age, doesn't he, when he's talking?
But then the question is, is he relevant still? Let's depersonalise it. Not just is he relevant, but is that wing of the Conservative Party relevant? And actually, if you look at them numerically on the back benches, there are still a big chunk of One Nation Tories there who are keeping pretty silent at the moment and keeping their eye on what happens to the party. And what's going to be really interesting to see as the party, as the Tory party goes through these phases that he mentioned of you know, earning back public trust, I think that'll take a very long time, and starting to sort of, you know, set out a policy platform and so on, is how involved they will be, whether he will feel that it is imperative on him to speak up on some of the big issues that he knows quite a lot about because he's been at the top of government. And we don't know the answer to that yet.
Do you know, one final thing that I'd pull out, he was very keen there to praise Kemi Badenoch and saying that she had the right strategy not to pull out policies this early on. You need to take your time and you need to rebuild trust, as you're saying. He also said we need to not get involved in too many social media wars, and he just said it in passing, and I thought,
and why what was that reference for, Kieran?
Well, I suspect that is a reference to Kemi Badenoch's habit of going on Twitter and picking fights with almost everybody that she can find, although he was trying to say, you know, she's doing a good job as leader and she's got the right idea and don't worry about the lack of policy. You could just tell there was a little glint in his eye as he was saying, and also, could we maybe stay off Twitter for a little bit?
And now the Tory party generally is in a pretty difficult place, but they didn't quite face annihilation as some had predicted at the general election. That might, of course, come round next time, the next general election, unless they turn things round. And it feels that in the short term, there is always this pressure, isn't there, for political leaders to set out their policy proposals. But I think what she's rightly identified, actually, is that they just get lost. No one listens to opposition until about, you know, 6 months before a general election, certainly in terms of what they're saying they would do differently in government. So it's about taking the fight to Labour, holding Labour to account, and then further down the line, developing a policy platform that offers an alternative. You know, so far so good on that. I mean, it's very, very early days. But the biggest challenge that she definitely has, the biggest challenge the Tory party definitely has, is how they address the rise of Reform and the populist right without doing what Jeremy Hunt has just suggested that they shouldn't, which is lurching to the right. They would end up losing that sort of broader coalition, which includes people like those in his seat in Surrey that voted for him over the Lib Dems, and could end up finding themselves losing many, many more seats and the Reform Party becoming, you know, the official opposition, if not even in an even stronger position at the next election. So it's really tricky times ahead for them, how they take that line without the temptation always to kind of pitch on migration, on the environment, on sort of social issues, always pitching to the right.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure even that line is possible to tread. And I think that's what they found at the last election. I just don't think those two coalitions of voters can be reconciled. And if anything, I found Jeremy Hunt a little Pollyanna-ish in his outlook that this electoral coalition could be stitched back together again. I'm not sure it's there.
Not in the short term anyway. And 5 years does not feel like a very long time for the Tory party to begin, given how people feel about politics and politicians in general. For the Tory party in particular to begin to sort of earn back some of that public faith.
Especially not, as you mentioned to him, with Reform currently leading the polls.
Yeah. So that's all from us. Please like and follow Politics Weekly UK to make sure you keep getting our episodes in your feed. John Harris is back on Thursday. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Cocoutier, and the executive producer is Zoe Hitch. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
This is The Guardian.
Wir sind Theresa und
Nemo.
Und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Boards-Shop dadurch auch auf den Mobilgeräten eine gute Figur. Und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.
Enjoying this podcast? Then we think you might love the audio long read. The podcast of The Guardian Long Read, showcasing the best long-form journalism with episodes about everything from the rise of ADHD to the double life of an alleged Russian spy. The Long Read offers great stories and big ideas. Follow the audio long read wherever you get your podcasts.